No rest till dawn!
No rest till dawn!
No rest till dawn!
Hello, and welcome to Codex, a casual lore podcast. My name is Phil. And his name would be Logan, but unfortunately he is out with the novel coronavirus. So today's episode is going to be a little weird. I guess to not break the rhythm of the show, at least. I know we will get into today's topic, which is generally Flintlock, the Siege of Dawn, and kind of the world building going on in there. But before we do, we have to get into bright spots and. I think Logan's bright spot is he's been digging into the zombies edition of Modern Warfare 3 lately, and he has found some joy in doing that while dealing with pharmaceuticals and also being down with COVID. My bright spot is, let's see. I this weekend went and finally bit the bullet and bought a gaming PC. So I've been actually playing Flintlock and a couple of other things lately on that new PC. It's my first gaming PC that I've had kind of ever, now that I think about it. And it's been a fun and also infuriating as a Mac guy, but we're getting there. It's been a couple days and I think I finally know how it works. You know, so that's fun. All right. So today's episode is probably going to be a little weird and a little short since I'm just doing it solo, and we'll see how that goes. But I've recently been playing Flintlock, the Siege of Dawn, which is a Souls Light, I guess, is the way that they're describing it. It's a Souls-like combat, and you play as Nora Vanek, who is a sapper, which in my mind will always just be that massive Uruk-hai who just runs through Helm's Deep with a torch and jumps into a thing and explodes the wall. That's a sapper. They lay bombs and explode them. But it's been a fun game to play. It's on Game Pass right now. And the thing that's kind of throwing me about it is Elden Ring was my first Souls, game ever. And I really enjoyed it, but I am a dad and I have probably an hour and a half, 2 hours of gaming a night. So bumping my head up against bosses and everything is not really the way that I like to spend my evenings. I like to make some progress. And I guess, as you can understand from a show that digs into the lore of things, I'm a little bit more interested in exploring the world and the stories than, you know, mastery. That's, I would say that's probably more Logan's thing than mine. But that's the kind of thing that's been fun about Flintlock, is that I think it falls a bit more into the Jedi Survivor angle, maybe, where it has its difficulty moments, but I'm not struggling too hard, especially a couple hours into it. But it's also seems to be a game that is that AA kind of indie, not quite AAA, but has some money behind it area. And I've been a little bummed out lately, seeing not a lot of people talking about it. So this show primarily, like our primary resources that we go through, we can't play all the games that we talk about. So some of it is from childhood memory of things like Assassin's Creed, and some of it is more digging into the wikis and kind of what the fans have put together, what are the actual notes and stuff in the games. And Flintlock, it's new, it's been out I think maybe like 3 weeks now, but because there's not this huge groundswell of people who are really into it and playing it and everything, it makes it pretty difficult to find the people who are so dedicated to playing the game and like digging into the lore and everything that there are no resources. So everything that I'm pulling from here is just straight from my experience playing a game that is definitely challenging and I'm sure has secrets that I'm missing. So it's kind of been this interesting thing of, you know, well, let's tear apart what the actual show that we're trying to do here is, because with the 5 pages in the fandom wiki that I think were probably seeded by the dev team originally, there's not a lot to go off. And I think you're missing out on some of the best parts, because no one's done the work of sitting down and saying like, oh, these are who the gods are. This is the entire setup of the game and things like that. So let's dig into Flintlock, the Siege of Dawn, and maybe the best place to start is, what is Dawn? And why is it being sieged? So Dawn is a large city in the nation, I guess, whatever conglomeration of nations it is. It is a large capital city, has a pretty big mountain behind it, and some point 10 years ago from when you start playing the game, a gateway of sorts was opened inside the mountain that Dawn abuts. The door was opened and the entire city is overrun by zombies. So they're, you know, all a bunch of the dead rise up and push all the people out of the city. It's completely under attack. And the siege is the coalition of nations, which is a I guess, like Napoleonic-styled army, whether it's a confederation of a bunch of different nations or if it is just one nation that is called the coalition. It's not really quite clear. But they are sieging this larger city, Dawn, for 10 years to hold back the dead. And then the inciting incident of the game is that you play as Norvanic, who is a sapper, and she and her team are going into Dawn, fighting through the trenches laid outside the city and all the cannon fire and all of that. It very much is this Napoleonic, it's like the Battle of Waterloo. Like, it is like very much in my wheelhouse of Napoleonic warfare that we don't really see a lot in games specifically. So you fight through the city, you become very well accustomed to Norvanix. She has a cool axe as her primary weapon, and a flintlock pistol that kind of interrupts enemies as you play. And as you go through the city, you meet up with your sapper squad, and you lay down a big old thing of gunpowder, and you blow open this door, this doorway into that would lead further into the mountains. And then you are met by something that in the subtitles is depicted as the Guardian of the Door. And it is a giant, griffin, I suppose, that has a very Egyptian style face mask on it that has 3 eyes. It's called the Guardian of the Door, and it basically blows up all of your stuff, and you fall into the water, and you know, you find your way saved by a being called Enki, which is a small fennec fox that's black and kind of feathery and stuff. And Enki is your companion throughout the rest of the game. So you'll get, like, you know, your source of magic is through Enki. You'll have he'll do some things for your gunpowder that makes you jump better, so you get a double jump pretty quickly, and a good air dash. So it's much more mobility-based than something like a Dark Souls or an Elden Ring. But I think the thing that really jumps out to me in playing Flintlock is that there's a couple of really cool world-building things that are happening here. So the first is like the Napoleonic bit. Like, I really appreciate that we've set this world in a much more like mid, like early 1800s to mid 1800s like styling. So you'll see a lot of the coalition army specifically are very much based on like Napoleonic uniforms, or like moving a little bit more Victorian sometimes. And it's just a visually interesting thing to look at. Like, the first place you go to is called, I think it's called the Wandering Peaks or the Something Peaks. And they're much more typical fantasy. It's, you know, knights with shields and big swords, and there's hammer guys and all of that. which is fine, and that's kind of what you expect from fantasy stuff. But it's just really impressive to go to a game that has, like, you know, you'll ultimately get, like, a grenade launcher, and you will get a musket that you can, you know, use to snipe enemies, and you'll have your flasks to heal, but you'll also end up with grenades. So they're just, like, really interesting differences that you can do when you introduce black powder and industrialization into a game that is predominantly just a fantasy game that has cool portals that you can jump through. And that's kind of the second thing that I really enjoy about the world building here, is that you don't get, there's not a huge, like, here is the map of the world and let's talk about the history of these nations and all of that in the beginning of this game. Like, there's a little bit of it talking about Dawn and what's going on there. But for the most part, you just kind of experience the story as you go, and you'll end up picking up different pieces of lore, I guess, as, like, items, like journal pages and stuff. But for the most part, the game does a really good job of explaining the dynamics of the world simply by letting you play the game. And that feels like a very silly thing to say, but the introduction of black powder specifically in this game, I think, is a really cool thing that is mostly just a mechanic. You know, you interrupt people with, you know, you pull the right trigger and you interrupt a red unblockable attack. And that's like part of the combat that you'll play. And it's happens like every 10 seconds when you're in the combat. Like, it is a very prominent part of the game. But I think the thing that's impressive about it is that the association with black powder and the gods that are let loose when you attack the guardian of the door, like, black powder is an evil in this world. Like, it is the thing that has allowed the coalition to siege Dawn and hopefully work its way to securing the city again. But it is also an evil. And the game is not kind of pulling punches on that at points. Like, when you, the first time you go to the peaks, which is that first kind of like snowy mountaintop zone, you go there to get help from them, the judges and the knights that live on the peaks. But you also go there because the peaks have mines in them, and the mines have sulfur and all of the things you need to make black powder. So when the judges originally were there and they claimed this area, they brought law and order, and that didn't go over very well after a while. So they fell back to, you know, maintaining their singular keep, and then relied on trade with all of the nations who have moved to gunpowder. And it's clear that the people who are living there, who have to work in the mines, they obviously don't like that work, nor the main character also had previously worked in mines and has, like, very strong feelings about having to be a miner and how she was trying to leave. And even the gods that you interact with, you know, the guardian of the door, as well as Enki, who you learn pretty quickly is the god of death, which has some complicating factors for a person who is trying to stop the dead from invading the world of the living. It's very clear that gunpowder, specifically, is something that can kill the gods. Whether it's the explosive powder specifically, or if there is something that is intrinsic to, like, the sulfur, or like the process of making the explosions, it's unclear right now where I am. I've beat the first major boss. I think I have one more, and then there's the final. But I just really appreciate how much the, like, black powder is not just like, and look, you have a gun. It is very much that, like, the peaks area that you go to, the god who has taken over and kind of, like, seated in that place, has stopped all production of gunpowder, and they have pulled all of the gunpowder back to the keep and, like, removing it from the people who could impose any sort of resistance to this order, specifically because it is black powder. Like, these people who live here are, you know, they are knights. They have, like, been able to fight with swords and things like that, but it is the black powder that needs to be pulled. It needs to be pulled away from the coalition and not given to them at all, so that they can further siege Dawn. But also, we need to pull it back so that it cannot be used to defeat the gods. So that there's some interesting thing going on that, you know, because of black powder, which I'm assuming you know, it's unclear, but I'm assuming black powder was used at some point to open this gateway between either the realm of the dead or the realm of the gods and the human realm, or, you know, something was going on there. But it's odd that gunpowder specifically is something that the gods are wary of and kind of concerned about it, which I really appreciate. That's an interesting way of building a game mechanic into something that is, you know, ostensibly just like pull right trigger, stop attack. But it's cool that it's there. I think something else that I'm really enjoying about Flintlock is there are just small little pieces of things that you just run into and you're like, oh, that's a weird, interesting take on something I have never really noticed in games like this. So I think maybe the most obvious one is you go through the game and every once in a while you come across a hamlet that is under attack. You have to defeat a couple of enemies in there, and then you have to defeat the like outpost boss, which I think is very similar to something you'd see in like an Assassin's Creed game or something like a Far Cry, where there's a big local boss, you defeat them, and then you kind of move on, get your reward. But the cool thing about Flintlock is that when you do that, you end up defeating the boss in the area, and then you're able to bring people back to that hamlet. So you go from a burned out village that is just, you know, filled with dead dudes or like some other, like the knights have laid siege to this town, and you go there and you clear them out, and then, you know, there's a quick swap and now all the fires are out, the, you know, beautiful sun is out, and it's a nice clean day in this wonderful hamlet. And life returns. So as you go through, you're like clearing out the plague of darkness, and then you're kind of being rewarded with the sign of like these hamlets coming back to life. You have made a change in the world, which is cool. But the thing that I like the most is that when you end up doing that, like every fantasy, it feels like every fantasy story that you end up running into is, you know, there's a tavern. Like there's always a bar, there's always a tavern. And the fun twist that Flintlock has is that, oh, it's a coffee shop this time. There's always a coffee shop. So you clear out the towns, and then it kind of like wipes away and shows you that this town is now thriving with dropping you into a coffee shop where there's people all around you and everything's nice. And people are talking about, like, you know, you pick up little pieces of interstitial dialogue here and there about, you know, how they can finally travel safely or things like that. But it's just fun that it's a coffee shop instead of a tavern. Like I think kind of taking the Napoleonic bend to it a little bit, where I think it says a lot about the hamlets and the towns that you visit, that the center of social life within them isn't a tavern, which I think is easy to associate with like drunkenness and revelry, and instead it is a coffee shop. It is a round coffee shop. The host sits in the center, which we will talk about the host in a second. And then there's people in cushions all around it. It's a very like North African kind of relaxing coffee shop, which I think has a different bend to it, right? Like you see that and you think, okay, well this is enlightened now. Like we're not just talking about like people having fun and everything. Like these people are lounging here, they're being relaxed. And also this nation is moving forward, these towns are moving forward because they're, you know, even silly things like, well, they're focused on stimulants instead of depressants, right? Like we are stimulating this place, we are not necessarily depressing it with revelry. Which is just an interesting thing. I think the probably more interesting thing that the game is more interested in saying when you go there is you are immediately greeted by the host, and the host is the place where they're the shop. Basically they give you a new healing flask. Whenever you clear out a hamlet, you get a new healing flask, which is nice. And then you can buy new uniforms, which is also, you know, that really hits me in the, I like to have coats with lots of buttons, part of my play games with fashion thing. But the host is not human, and it is completely unacknowledged at all throughout the entirety of the game so far that there is a being of sorts, which is just basically a I don't know, like 6, maybe 8 foot tall mound. And this mound has about 10 or 12 arms with hands on them. And they are draped with robes. And the biggest, highest up two hands pick up a giant mask and they pose it as if it is a head and move it and kind of emote that way. But there is no face behind the mask. And they are just called hosts. They are all called hosts. They don't have specific names. There's nothing really, like, there's no description of them. And like I said, there's, like, very little by way of, you know, lore pickups or anything in this game in general. And there's nothing mentioning the hosts. The only thing I was able to come across about the hosts, and this is why they are very interesting to me now, is that they know something, and they know, they have some knowledge of the Great Below, which is a capital G, capital B, Great Below, which is where the dead go. Like, that is, I guess, like the purgatory of sorts. It is, if I remember the way that it is explained, the Great Below is the place where all of the souls in the game go. When someone dies, they go to the Great Below, and then Enki, the god of death, should listen to their life story, and then their life story is remembered by Enki forever, and then they kind of, the souls flow into the great beyond. But the hosts know something about that. And they, what they know, it's very difficult, but they have some sort of lived knowledge of having been to the Great Below in some form, which I think is fascinating. Like, how, I'm sure that this game does not dig into that at all, but I would be very curious if there's just, like, slight little pieces here or there that are just like, oh yes, like, the hosts are, like, reincarnated souls, and now they come back, or they're amalgamations because they have many different arms, or, like, their entire purpose is to come and be, you know, a warm, happy spirit for all of the world to interact with. But there's nothing so far, which I think is also kind of nice. Because it's good to have a good little mystery, you know? I think the last couple things I wanted to talk about, and these are more just kind of one-off things. You run into one of your old sapper buddies. That's kind of what you end up doing when you get back to base camp. You'll go through these different mission areas, and you'll ultimately pick up members of your old crew that were kind of, you know, spread to the wind. And as you pick them up, they'll be the people who end up upgrading your gear, and then they end up giving you, like, fun little missions to do every once in a while. But one of them that you run into, I think his name is Luca, you run into him about halfway through the Peaks mission, and you're talking with Enki, and because he has some burns on his face of some variety. And there's just an offhand mention by Enki that it is not, like, a powder burn from the explosive attack that you did against the Guardian of the Door. It is some sort of mark that's left by the old magic, which, again, there's not really any actual explanation for. Like, there's not, you have Enki, the god, who is working with you, and you can, as a player, control him, but there's not, like, you don't have magical powers. You have curses, and they're called witherings, that Enki can do. So there's this introduction now of, okay, well, there's actually the old magic too, which may have something to do with how the door at dawn was opened originally, but I'm not quite sure yet. And then kind of the last thing, since I spent so much time in there, the keep and the judges, which I think is just like another kind of fun area to visit in, like, a fantasy setting that just feels very fresh to me. Maybe that's a good descriptor for how I've been feeling about this game in general. But the keep is this large keep that's kind of right at the end of the main first area. And it is after the city of Writ, which is Writ, which makes a lot of sense when the entire thing is based on judges. And the keep is this large, really cool castle, and has, like, you know, what you expect of a big fantasy castle. But at the end, you like go all the way up to the top, and there are these three giant, super tall pillars. And at the top are the three judges. And the three judges are this like triumvirate of rulers who rule over all of the peaks. And they have been obviously corrupted by Ramuha, which is the god that has taken up residency there. But they are not from this area of the peaks. They had previously, like hundreds and hundreds of years ago, they had traveled from some far off land, and they had giant tusked creatures that very clearly are elephants throughout the motifs that you'll see throughout the castle. And they came to the peaks, and then they established this very law and order, almost Spartan kind of way of life. And then, having been on the peaks, their elephants from far off slowly died of disease, and over time they lost them all. The people rebelled, and then they reverted back to these judges, who the judges end up ruling this area very like they are the dictators of the area. So they keep everyone oppressed and kind of just keep the mines open so that commerce can continue and enriching the city, because they can't actually control the rest of it. But it's just an interesting, again, like when you're playing this game, it is not very important that the judges work this way. And these all are all pieces of like interesting lore that you picked up as you play, and kind of like hear how some of the more on your side knights kind of react. But it is just very interesting to see a different kind of fantasy going on here, and I really enjoyed being in that area. And then the final thing here is the gods themselves. Like the big marketing push for this game was kill all gods. Like that is the thing that is part of it, is that like there are at least three gods in this game. There is Ramuha, which is the three armed god of, good question, I think justice, but I'm not quite sure. I assume justice of some variety, since she is with the judges. There is another one who I cannot remember their name. They are the middle one, the one I'm on right now, in the more desertish zone. There is the guardian of the door, who is potentially actually the final boss, whose name is Uru. Unclear what they're the god of. And then there is Enki, who is the god of death, the one who comes with you, the one who saves you, basically, and gives you the ability to go through rifts and defeat the dead and cool power-ups and all of that. There is, though, one final god, I think, and it is the god that gives you, you know, it increases your life in a very video gamey kind of thing. You go and pray at this pillar. It's just a obelisk, but it has a glowing red center, and it shoots a red beam up in the air, and you should go there. It gives you more health, and it's very helpful early on. But this god is forgotten, and no one living knows who this god is. And Enki kind of mentions that no one has really believed in this god in a long time, and they've kind of fallen behind. And it leads. It just makes the game feel like it has a better grip on its cosmology than maybe it actually does. This idea that there is, you know, that there is a gateway between the living and the dead, or the living and the divine, around Dawn, which is also an interesting name for a place that is, you know, a new day, or you know, maybe there are some things that are about to be changing there a lot. And also that there are living and dead gods, that there are potentially, you know, you kill Ramuha, I guess, spoilers, you defeat the boss, and guess what? They die. So gods can die, specifically at the hands of someone who is powered by Enki, the god of death. But also Enki explains that he has different names. So he's been referred to as Enki, I think is his actual name, but he makes it easier for people to say Enki. But this name is not known to Nor as you play. Like the notion that he's the god of death is a revelation at the end of the Ramahof fight. And these names aren't known. So either that means that the humans in the coalition maybe all humans are godless of some variety, or religion is not something that is taken up by many of them. And that the real names of gods are not known. They're only referred to as the god of death or the god of justice, which is also, you know, another interesting thing where, you know, if you don't have names, then those gods can't be distorted. You know, you can't have, you know, Ares and Mars. You simply have the god of war, and the god of war continues on, and it is passed along in some sort of religious way. But I think it's interesting that the names aren't shared, so that when you come across this, the pillar that heals you, it is a god that Enki is aware of and has known, but perhaps they died a long time ago. And Enki has some level of remorse or feeling about that loss. And maybe that'll be revealed a little bit more as I get deeper into the game. But it's interesting that the cosmology is also older than it appears, but is perhaps not as well known by the people that inhabit the world, which then, you know, brings us full circle. But, you know, the great below, which is the place where the souls go, is known and is seemingly believed to be a true actual place because of what the hosts have mentioned. So there is some level of magic in the world or otherworldly beings. But, you know, the person who rules over the great below is not known on a named basis, which I think is an interesting twist. You know, how could you possibly have met a dude named Enki after you've been fighting the army of the dead for 10 years and not know that that person is the person who may have started all of this or didn't? You know, that's kind of also the mystery of the game as you go forward. But yeah, that's, I don't have a ton of other stuff as it comes to Flintlock. I mean, honestly, it's just been a blast to play through and kind of see how this, like, I don't know, the AA game, I guess, feels weird to call it that. It's just a good, small, like, correctly scoped feeling Souls-like that is fun to play. But just to see how it kind of incorporates all of these different slight twists on the typical Souls-like, you know, genre in some variety. You know, like, you have a lot of stuff that's coming from Bloodborne, I guess, especially with, like, the pistol dynamics and things like that. But it is colorful. Like, the zone I am in right now is, like, the desert zone, and I guess it is very similar to what I would expect of, like a coastal Portuguese area, or like somewhere in like Northern Africa or something like that. It is vibrant. It is beautiful. You know, it's crystal clear blue water. Like, it is not the oppressive soul's light. Everything can kill you around every corner kind of feeling. Like, these towns are populated. There are people around. They have things to say. You know, you can't really talk to them all that often, but there's a lot more going on here than I kind of would have expected from a game in this genre. You know, normally those are dark and moody and no one really says anything, or if they do, it's incredibly cryptic. And this is a bit more hand-holding in some degree, but it's just been a really fun experience of seeing something that takes a twist on, like, fantasy tropes and kind of the tropes that have been set out by other Souls-like games, and just does something interesting with it. Like, it really is a twist on a lot of the things that I've seen, and honestly, a lot of things that have pushed me away from those games in general. Like, it is not a terribly punishing experience. It is difficult sometimes, but it's not punishing in kind of a Dark Souls kind of way, or at least, you know, what I've been led to believe those are. But there is lore that you can discover, and that there is good world building in here that, you know, makes you think about things as you go through the game, more than, you know, that there is a reason why the castle is in this mountain, and it is not just because it is a cool fantasy setting. You know, that there's a reason that you visit a graveyard in the second zone for all the coalition troops, and you are able to get Nor's, you know, first person experience of having lived in those trenches for years. You know, that there's good cosmology building here. There's good reason for there to be black powder weapons that isn't just, what if we made a Souls light and also you had a gun? And I think that that's really impressive. Like, it is it is maybe not super difficult to find a good lore reason to do those things, but it is very much something that does not happen a lot in modern video games. Like, ultimately, the verbs that you end up playing with in some, if not most games are just, well, we thought this was cool. And ultimately, that's how it feels as a player. And I think the thing that is really impressive about Flintlock is that they did the work to make it feel like, you know, this is here for a reason. And there are stakes, and there are reasons that this exists, and why it is going to play into not just how you play the game, but how the game will end up ending, which I think is really impressive. So yeah, that's we'll keep it short, since, you know, there's half of us, so half an episode, right? I think that'll be the end for now on Flintlock, the Siege of Dawn. And I will let you get back to your wonderful day after this. If you like the show, tell a friend, rate and review on your podcast player of choice. Visit GordonHamburger.com. That's where you can go to read reviews, find links to Twitch and YouTube. We have plans to start streaming some stuff a little bit more, coming up in the next couple weeks. So, go there, subscribe and do all that fun stuff. If you want to send a message or recommend a piece of world building for us to look into, something like Flintlock or something different, just visit the contact page on the site. Or if you, for some reason, really enjoyed this solo meditative ramble on world building that had no codex entries to actually go off of, just either leave a review on like iTunes or something, or shoot me a message. I would love to discuss this game more. I wish more people would give it a shot and see what it's all about. Our music is done by Logan and I's very good friend, Nicholas Cahill. So you can check out his SoundCloud with the links in the show notes. I have been Phil. You can follow me on Threads at Phil Bothan. And Logan obviously is offline. Maybe he will expose his username on OSRS one of these days. But yes, thank you for listening, and we will be back next week with another Codex entry. Thank you.